Welcome to Mission Critical, a podcast about the big picture, the purpose, and the values that drive today's most game-changing companies, entrepreneurs, and leaders. I'm your host, Lance Chung, Editor-in-Chief of Glory Media, and I'll be introducing you to a group of brilliant minds who are making an impact on the world and forging the path ahead. While they may all be very different from each other, the question remains the same. What's your mission? Emily, I am so excited to be chatting today. How are you?
I'm awesome. Sun's out, temperature's warmer.
Yeah.
Couldn't be happier.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, especially in Toronto too. we've known each other for a hot minute. I think first time we met in person was probably last year at our spring party, right?
Yes.
Yeah. And that was so great. And I've been such a fan of everything that you do, the brand that you're building and your story, and also just like your general vibe and energy. Like, it's just so great. And it's so, I'm so glad that we can actually like have a sit down chat and talk about your whole journey.
Sure. Yeah. I'm here
also,
for it.
I have to say that I'm a huge snack fiend. So I probably snack more than I eat like meals. Like I just graze throughout the day and it's always like snacks. And it's a big part of my childhood. It's so nostalgic. And so I kind of wanted to start off by doing a quick rapid fire.
Yes.
A snack themed rapid fire. To be on theme with our chat today.
Let's go.
Okay. Starting question. What is your all-time favorite flavor of popcorn?
I would say truffle salt.
Ooh.
Truffle salt, yeah.
Okay. And are you like doing that, like sprinkling that on top at the end, or are you like kind of like mixing in the oil when you're...
Yeah, you do it with oil and then you sprinkle the truffle oil and then you sprinkle truffle salt on top. So it's a homemade favorite flavor.
And are you like a layering person or like just on the top kind of person?
I'm a just on the top.
Okay.
Yeah.
Yeah. I think I'm the same way too, actually.
Because then it can become too much.
Yeah. Okay. When it comes to snacks, crunchy or chewy?
Crunchy.
Crunchy. Okay. Yeah, I don't like it when it's like all up in your like teeth and everything. <You know? laughs> Do you have any guilty pleasure snacks that you indulge in when you need like a good pick me up, other than like your own product?
Oh yeah, you never get high on your own supply. So yeah. Passion flakies all the way.
Ooh, okay, nice.
Throwback, yeah.
What's the most unusual or unexpected ingredient you've experimented with in your kind of snack lab?
Jam.
Oh, okay.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
And how did that go?
So when I was, you know, where I was when I started this whole journey, we had access to very limited ingredients, right. And peanut butter and jam were one of those things that we had. And so I'd melt peanut butter and melt jam and put it on top of popcorn.
And did you love it?
Yeah. And yeah. Then we actually turned it into a commercialized flavor of
yes.
it.
Yes. Yeah. Amazing. Okay. Movie night snack essentials. What are your must-haves for the perfect movie situation in a theater or at home?
Oh, the sour Jolly Ranchers.
Okay.
Dr. Pepper.
Yes.
And popcorn. Other than popcorn? Or did you say...
In general.
Oh, yeah. Okay. I would say the Dr. Pepper and then the sour Jolly Ranchers. Absolutely.
Do you ever get those like weird kind of like offshoot flavors at the movie theater of pop where it's like, I don't know if it's considered an offshoot, but like... cherry vanilla or like kind of like all these like random things that you can't find at like convenience stores and stuff.
Yeah, you can get them at like Wendy's and like, you know, built in those big machines and
yeah.
then you press the button and I think it's a Coca-Cola machine and then they have all these different kinds of flavors of pop and then you can choose like light, no sugar, full flavor, raspberry, and then you can customize each flavor. So
when I think about the movie theater experience when I was younger and compared to now and like even just going to like a pop machine, it's like you're working with a robot. Like it's trying to figure out all your combinations and everything like that. Oh my God. Okay. Are there any snacks from your past that you wish you would make a comeback onto store shelves?
The Toronto Blue Jays marshmallows when they won the World Series.
Okay.
A specialized version of marshmallows and they're all Blue Jays.
Yeah,
when
yeah,
they
yeah.
won the World Series and that was 1993-94.
I don't think I had, were they like flavored?
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
Oh my God. Amazing. If you were to host a nostalgic snack-themed party, what would be on the menu?
Twinkies. Big League Chew Gum.
Okay. Oh, my God. Yes. Yes, yes, yes.
Is it Sour Gobstoppers? Gobstoppers are love because then you don't like overdose on sugar.
Yes.
You know, you kind of have to take your time.
Yeah.
And then I love nerds too.
Nerds. You know, I can't remember who I had this chat with, but I was talking to someone about the candy of our youth. And we were talking about how so many of, or there was like this weird category where of candy that was like made to look like tobacco and cigarettes.
Oh yeah, Popeyes.
Popeyes.
Those Popeyes sticks. Yeah.
It's like such a weird, and like the Big League Chew is like supposed to be like tobacco.
Yeah,
like,
yeah.
It's okay, crazy yeah. that was marketed to kids.
Yeah.
Oh my gosh.
And you can't forget the double bubble when they did the partnership with Spice Girls, and then every package you'd open would have like the different Spice Girls.
Yeah, sticker, yeah.
And
yeah,
you try to like collect them all and just like get so many cavities just where you come.
Yeah, yeah. I'm like, exactly. I love that. I love all the snack talk. I'm going to go and grab a bunch of snacks after a chat too. But, you know, it's a great segue into kind of our conversation today because it's such a foundational part of your story and your business. And also, like, everyone, you know, it's something that anyone can relate to in a different way. Maybe a great way to start off is, you know, can you share a little bit about what Comeback Snacks is and kind of like what the origin story of that and how that happened?
Yeah, well, it started in the most unlikely and most unfortunate places, which was federal prison. Mm. And, you know, like most people, I didn't wake up and was like, hey, I'm gonna be in prison one day. But I ended up there because I was struggling with substance abuse at the time in 2013, 2014. My family was a mess. It was just, you know, they were going through a hard time and it was hard for me. And then I also got kind of told like, oh, you know, you shouldn't be like sad about this anymore. You're old enough. And so I was like, okay, I'll just try to stop being sad. So I began to like medicate with substances. Like, I'm not going to lie. Like I like to get drunk. Like before in university, I had a lot of good times on it. I'm not going to say, oh, like, oh, I had all these miserable times. But like once you go from celebrating to medicating, that's when it puts you in a really, really bad place. When you kind of don't have that control and it becomes like not fun anymore. It just becomes, you become like, it's like Botox for the soul.
Right.
So, yeah. And that was when I met someone through my work that, you know, wanted to help me get like soberish, I would say, because it was in a scary place. It was like almost like every day kind of thing. And he was sober. He asked me if I wanted to go on a trip. And I'd known this guy for like almost a year. So we had a close friendship and he's like, let's go on this trip. And I was like, that sounds like so much fun because it would be nice to have a sober trip, you know, maybe kind of kick this habit or get back in line. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not like I was like going down alleyways and like doing crazy, crazy things. I was just medicating myself almost every day in an unhealthy way. And I wanted to get out of it. Anyway, so he brings me on this trip. Everything's fine. And then 3 days into the trip, he tells me that we're actually there to work. His entire demeanor completely changes. He's like a different person. And he was, I guess, acting the whole time. And then, so when he'd booked the trip with my passport, he'd sent it off to these people that he owed money to, which were like drug cartel people. And yeah, and then so we get down there and I'm put in this car and we have to go work and get fitted to smuggle drugs back to Canada to help settle this debt. And they already have all of my information because he booked the tickets.
Oh my God.
So I'm trapped in this foreign country in St. Lucia and what looks like a bed and breakfast on the outside, but turns out there's all these people in there and then there's just like bricks and bricks and bricks of cocaine in the walls. And I thought he was joking. And then after like that whole day passed, I realized he wasn't joking. And that's when I freaked out and I got really nervous. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. People were like, oh, you should have called like the authorities, but they're like all in on it. They're like, there's so much corruption down there.
Well, and if you're in a different country, like it's,
what are they going to do?
Exactly. Yeah.
Like the safest way out is just to go home. Mm. And I told him I was going to be really bad at it. I was a horrible liar. You know, I failed acting classes. I'm serious.
Right.
Because I couldn't stop laughing when I was in these auditions.
Yeah.
But he just like wouldn't have it. He's like, no, he'd already like basically committed to these people that we were bringing drugs back and that bad things would happen or whatever if I didn't do it. And so I was like, well, I'll try my best, but I'm telling you now, like I'm really bad at it. I'm going to be really bad at this. And lo and behold, shuffling through the airport with 2 kilograms of cocaine strapped to my body, looked like a Kleenex box shoved under my shirt. Of course, we get called into secondary. I get arrested. And, you know, I'm thinking, okay, when can I just call my friends to bail me out?
Yeah.
Oh, it doesn't work like that. You know, turns out I'm going to be put on house arrest for 2.5 years, have to move back in with my parents at 26 years old. Who are
it's
going,
not like the movies.
Yeah.
Right.
It's not like, oh, call your friend. No. Like, there's no scrubbing graffiti off a wall, like, slap on the wrist. Like, right. This is a big freaking deal.
Yeah.
And so after spending all that time on house arrest while the case went through the system, you know, I pled guilty very early because I knew that just admitting, because obviously I'd brought something over a line, an invisible line, and that was illegal. They didn't care about how it happened. I wasn't about to go ratting anyone out, right? Mm. Because, that, again, that's dangerous. Like, you just suck it up and pay your dues. Mm. And that's when I knew I wasn't going to let it beat me. And by the time I, you know, went to prison, you know, shackled, like, I was escorted out of the courtroom. I surrendered to the court, shackled and shuffled out. And then that was the day of my comeback. That was the day that I knew I was going to build something good with it. Like, I wasn't going to let the stigma or people's thoughts of me or tell me what I was going to be. And went to prison, and where do I go from here? Oh, comeback snacks. Yeah. So it started with the mission to make a comeback. I didn't know what that vector was going to be.
Mm.
And when I got there, I saw and met so many people that were just like me, like, you know, were good people, just got mixed up in like really tough situations, but had so much talent and just wanted another chance. And popcorn was a popular prison snack. We would often put like different recipes on it. And we talk about our anxieties. One of those things was employment.
Mm.
And when I was in there, I saw, you know, mothers, I saw teachers, I saw artists, authors, like so many people with so much talent that, you know, I thought deserved another chance. And so Comeback Snacks was born in prison. And it was going to be a popcorn company where I could employ myself and others that needed second chances. So
it's so
in a nutshell.
Wild listening to your story, because it just seems so surreal and just like a Netflix limited series almost. Like, it's just so like the wild ride that you have taken throughout your journey is, I mean, how did you even stay focused on, you know, trying to make sure that you were, one, okay, and two, you know, even thinking about building a business and your comeback? Like, how did you even have kind of that clarity of mind to think like that?
Because I was done fighting for something bad, I wanted to fight for something good. And when you have this like relentless energy to like prove yourself and prove other people wrong, you have to channel that into something good. And so once I knew what that was going to be, it was like I couldn't stop. Like, everything, every day was important. Every word that someone else said, you know, whether it was a correctional officer or like my parole officer or the warden or the people inside prison with me, they're all part of this journey that I, you know, I was going to fight for my life. And that's what I did.
Yeah. Yeah. And so did you have like an aha moment where you're like, once you started having the kind of popcorn rituals with the people that you were meeting, like, was it like an aha moment, or was it more of like a slow burn to kind of figure out your way to building the business?
Well, it was an aha moment when it was going to be popcorn. That was during Super Bowl, and we were all just having these snacks and then talking about our work potential and what we were going to do and how much stress we had about just thinking about it, because no one believed in us and didn't even know us and hated us automatically. So that was the like aha day. But then I still had like 8 months left in prison at this time, because in the Canadian system, you're eligible for parole after 1/6 of your sentence, day parole. So I did about a year inside prison, the physical prison, and then I had to live in a halfway house and then full parole and then 4 years.
Right.
But so every single day I was like focusing on building that and writing letters to people. I read 82 books in prison, and so I started writing letters to the authors and telling them how like their stories like inspired me, and started to make connections that way. Made connections with the volunteers that came into the prison, who I now have like amazing partnerships with as well. And then when I got out, I got a job at the gym, because my parole officer was like, oh, you know, like, we don't really support entrepreneurial endeavors.
I was just about to say, yeah, like, the pursuit of entrepreneurship on any day is intimidating and challenging.
Yeah.
And so, yeah, like, were you encouraged to kind of find something that was like a bit more stable and consistent versus the path of entrepreneurship, which is kind of the opposite of that, I guess?
Absolutely. And you know what? They were right. But I got a job at the gym, which is also, you know, symbolic of starting over, fresh starts, all that. And I, for my resume for that job, I went in and I I had worked like 10 jobs in prison. You know, I was like a gardener. I was like a librarian. So I put all those jobs on that resume and I said, hi, I just got out of prison and I'm looking for a fresh start. Is there any opportunities here? And they hired me like on the spot with that resume of my prison resume.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. So I worked that and then simultaneously like, you know, going to Bulk Barn, buying spices. And then at night I would kind of work on the popcorn side of it. So,
okay. So let's focus on the popcorn side for a second.
Okay.
So when you're at home, like creating, like you've got kind of like a makeshift home, popcorn lab, I guess. And like a flavor lab, like
my mom's house.
Yeah. Your mom's house. Yeah. Like, what was the journey like from that point to actually having like a physical packaged product and a label and a name? Like, were you ideating a lot? Were you testing things out? And what point did you know that it was something that you had a viable product that you could start sharing with friends and start building a business off of?
Yeah. Number one is because I chose to share the story with like the media, but only on my terms. And so, mm-hmm. The Hamilton Spectator, that was like the local paper and gets like a lot of readers. And that was where I was living in the halfway house. And so I talked about this popcorn project in this story because I didn't want it to be held inside me. I wanted to share it with the world so that, you know, other people could know how this happens and also help other people maybe that were trying to get out of a similar situation.
Yeah.
And when that article came out, it was a Saturday paper. It was front cover on Saturday paper. And they also own like a number of other publications like Niagara and different regions.
Yep.
And so I went on that front cover too. And then we just got so much community support like coming in, like our website went insane. There was like store owners that wanted to carry it. There was people that wanted to give us free space at their, you know, market.
Wow.
And so I really say that it was a community built business, like from the ground up.
Cause
so, there's so many people were involved. Like there's a print company when you're talking about labels, a print company that gave us like $5,000 in free labels. Cause obviously you don't have big budgets when you're coming out of the joint.
Yeah.
But yeah, we built it that way and just constantly sharing and, with the flavors, in the beginning it was all mostly savory flavors, but once we started doing caramel, we found that people liked the caramel more.
Interesting.
Yeah.
Interesting. Yeah. Did you feel, was it scary to kind of put yourself out there and that story out there? Did you ever feel vulnerable with doing that first interview? Or were you like, you know what, I've already kind of been through the worst.
Yeah.
Let's commit to everything else afterwards.
I knew that it was going to come. Like I knew what the social media world was like. So it's not like everything when the first article came out, there's of course a whole bunch of nonsense, like, you know, lock away, throw away the key, all that kind of stuff, and people claiming that they knew me and that I didn't know and saying that I was, you know,
wow.
But like that was more motivating, like for me. Yeah. Like obviously it hurt. Of course it's gonna hurt. Like you can't be like, oh yeah, I'm fine with everything. It sucked, but I kind of rechanneled that energy again. And then as we've continued to build this over the last 4 years, there's pretty much none of that anymore. So the proof is in the popcorn and the people.
Right.
Right?
Yeah, proof is in the popcorn. And I guess also, how did you put yourself out there? You did a media interview, you discovered this really great upswell of community support. What did that experience teach you about asking for opportunity?
You got to do it. I mean,
yeah.
If you don't ask, you don't get. Like, but you also have to ask for forgiveness too, right? Mm. And asking for that comes out of taking accountability, taking responsibility. Like there were things in my life that I could have changed earlier. Obviously, I had no idea about this cartel operation. Like that's the next level. But maybe I shouldn't have just given up when they said I shouldn't have been sad about that. You know, like I could have tried to learn something like with the whole substance thing, try to do something like a little bit different. But again, like no one's immune to substance use or abuse. It doesn't matter who you are.
Yeah.
Right. So it's,
and it can affect any kind of income class or, you know, any kind of community too. Like you're not immune to it.
Yeah.
No, one's immune to it.
Yeah.
What were some of the more, you know, kind of most valuable lessons that you learned during your time, you know, in prison, and how did those really influence your personal and your professional growth?
Number one, like slow growth is good. Like nothing happens overnight. For example, when I pled guilty to going to prison, I kind of reframed it. So I learned that I had to reframe things in order to see the benefit of them. So I saw my time in prison. Okay, my legal fees were for $50,000. So what do we do? Like, if I'm going to spend $50,000 on something, it's certainly not just going to be prison. It's going to be my education, it's going to be my rehab, and it's going to be a sabbatical. All those things. All right, so a lot of people go away for a year with like limited access to things. And that goes to lesson number two, is that what you might think is limited access to things can actually open up a whole other area, a whole other realm of creativity. Like people think that in prison, like, you have nothing, but you actually have yourself, you have your comrades, you have your experience, and that's how you really learn to build something that matters to you, that's important, and that can help others.
Yeah, and I guess it is a little bit of a matter of perspective too, because reframing that kind of mindset and thinking about, I suppose, that time as like a reset and making the most out of that time too is not maybe necessarily the first thing that people would think of when they're spending time there, right? How do you think the general public's perception of prison life really differs from reality or your own kind of experience? Because I feel like people have kind of this like movie idea of what that's like, but how, in your experience, what was there anything surprising to you, or was it different, or was it kind of what you expected?
Well, going in there, I knew that it was going to be people that were just like me. But of course, where I went, I was in a medium security facility. And then there were people that were in there for, you know, pretty violent crimes, right? But then if you actually learn to meet those people, you learn how they got there, like the abuse that they went through and just significant trauma that people, like, and I had, like, no trauma, really. Like, sure, I was bullied in elementary school, whatever. Like, that was, like, nothing compared to, like, what a lot of these people went through. And they were alone and abandoned. And now you're, you know, villainized.
Yeah.
So I think that's what people on the outside, like, need to know. And I think when it comes to movies, of course, movies are always going to be movies. It's their job to dramatize things. But what I think is really helpful, like, right now, has been this movement towards prison reform, right? Like, when I was inside prison in 2018 and I started this thing, if I was in prison in 2008, people would not have had, like, the same kind of thoughts, because of these movements in the U.S., like, trying to humanize the experience and try to showcase that, like, a lot of, most people in prison are there because of significant trauma. That helps to reframe the public's perception. So more storytelling, more activism, and more people working to help change laws and create opportunities.
Yeah, and the awareness around that. And I guess it's understanding that it's not so much of like a black and white conversation. There's so much nuance and shades of gray and perspective and context. And really it's kind of about, I guess, embracing like a bit of an empathetic perspective to understand where, how people landed in those situations and how circumstantial it could have been as well, too.
Yeah, and I met people in there that were regular people that maybe they were on their phone and they hit someone. And, you know, they were, like, executives, right? But then all of a sudden it's like, oh, you're bad. You don't, like, wake up and then you look at your phone in the car or something and then, you know, now all of a sudden you're a criminal, right? It can change so quickly.
Right.
Like, so quickly.
Are there, you know, people that you met there that are still kind of people that you still stay in touch with, you know, a support group, people that would understand kind of your lived experience in that regard, I guess.
Yeah. I talked to like 5 or 6 of the people that I was in there with.
Yeah.
But then I also still talk to, like the teachers in prison that I had. I'm actually going to go speak, in Kitchener where the prison was. So one of my computer instructor in prison was also a high school teacher. And so I'm going up to Kitchener to speak for his classmates. Yeah.
Oh, great.
Yeah.
Can you discuss, you know, the role that Comeback Snacks has played in your mission to really advocate for prison reform? Mm-hmm. You know, you have a great product, and that alone, you know, stands on its own as just a great product, right? Mm-hmm. But it's also kind of this vessel and medium that you use to have bigger conversations around your experience. So what is really that conversation that you're trying to have?
That everyone can be employable that has been in prison. Mm-hmm. And so we do that through direct hiring. We're still small, but then I've also partnered with the John Howard Society, and they have something called the Fair Chances Coalition, and they bring on employers that also have fair chance hiring policies. It doesn't mean like they don't have record checks, but it just means they go through the steps to make sure like they are viewing this candidate properly. Like, do they have the skills? Do they have the talent?
Right.
And then what else do I do? Oh, and then I've worked on with the federal government on changing a law, like this law, it's called the mandatory minimum law. And so no matter who you are, like what the circumstance was, if you brought X number of drugs over the border, you were going to prison for X amount of time. Like there's no, they didn't look at anything else. And that actually causes way more harm than good. So I worked on that law and got that abolished, actually. There are no mandatory minimums at the federal level. And then at the Ontario level, I worked with Monty McNaughton last year. Okay. He's the Minister of Labor.
Yeah.
And he's like, Emily, I heard your story. And, I've always been thinking about prison reform for a while. And he created something called the Second Chances Initiative. And that was government funding. So, like, millions and millions of dollars that went towards employers that would build training programs for the formerly incarcerated as well.
Wow.
Yeah, so scaling the mission, for sure.
You've really been busy since building the brand in terms of how that, the impact in the community.
Yeah, it's so much fun. It's what keeps me going every day, really.
What do you think are some of the misconceptions that people have as employers when it comes to hiring individuals that have been in prison? Is it kind of like a stereotypical, what you would imagine to be a stereotypical kind of idea of the prejudice that they would have?
Yeah, definitely that prejudice, the risk, that we're not hardworking, steal, violence, all those things. But another thing that I noticed, like through the work that I've done, was it's actually a lot to do with insurance.
Okay.
Because it's more expensive to have business insurance for employees that have records. So that's why they might like the employee, but then from a cost perspective, that's when they get shut out. Yeah.
So it's like a numbers. So does that mean that there is an argument to be made about reform with that conversation with insurance companies as well then?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. That's my next goal, next target.
Yeah. I love it. Just tackling one thing at a time.
That's it. Climb every mountain.
Beyond that, what are the kind of the support systems and resources that are, you believe are really crucial for individuals to have once they are entering back into the community and I guess like the real world? What do you find is important and is lacking?
I think what's important is making sure you surround yourself with like forward thinking people, because sometimes if you go back and you hang out with that same group of friends or whatever, like that group that wants you to get revenge. And, because when I got out, I was so mad. So I surrounded myself, when I was arrested and I was on house arrest, I was so mad. And I was hanging around people that, encouraged me to be mad, encouraged me to like get even, right? And that's actually like really dangerous. And I don't want to think like that anymore. And so it was kind of getting out of those circles. That was the first one. And also, wait, what was the question? Oh, what supports?
Yeah, supports and resources that that would be helpful to have.
Oh yeah, like job opportunities, like employment. There's in the United Kingdom, there are employers that actually go into the jails and do recruiting. We don't have any of that here. So what I'm learning is like studying the different prison systems around the world and trying to bring some of those into Canada.
Right.
Where they can go in, and then when they get out, they have a job, right? Yeah. And that's motivating for them to stay on the straight and narrow in prison and also feel comfortable and believe in themselves when they get out.
Yeah. I mean, when we have a lot of these discussions about change and bringing change to a lot of like these institutional spaces and bureaucratic spaces, what do you find has been the, I guess, path of least resistance in chipping away from that block and making an impact when it comes to these big institutions? Like, what have you found to be the best way to make a difference, I guess?
With the big institutions?
Yeah, where things are a little bit more bureaucratic and the needle's a little bit harder to move.
You just have to start with one person. Find that one person that kind of works on those things, like whether it's a politician or someone on a committee. I worked with Pam Dimoff specifically with the with Liberals. I worked with Monty McNaughton specifically, right? So when you think of, oh, the government on Ontario, oh, it's massive. Oh, the federal government, it's massive. Try to just get to know like the one person that believes in your cause and work with them, because, when you find someone that believes in you, like they want to see you succeed. And so just like I want to see everyone else succeed, the people that believe in me also want to see me succeed.
Right? And trying to make a change within within arm's reach, I guess, the people that are in within arm's reach.
Yeah, because you'd be surprised. There are a lot of people that I've met along the way that work in these institutions that have friends and family that have even been through the system, right? Maybe they just don't talk about it publicly, but there's every single person has someone close to them that's struggled, whether it's with substances or, you know, crime or, you know, things that we think create nefarious people, but it's just not true.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. So coming back to your company now, how long has it been since you, what do you consider like the official date of your start date of your company?
Well, when we made our first dollar, I think.
Okay. Yeah.
So that was 2019, the beginning.
And where did you make that first dollar?
My friend had an event at a bar and I wasn't allowed to go because I was on parole. So like I spent like 8 hours in my mom's kitchen. I had this like little tiny popper making 120 little bags of popcorn. Took me 8 hours.
Yeah.
And the whole house smelled like popcorn. It was like Popcorn Palace.
Yeah.
My mom's house. But yeah, so that was at a place in Hamilton, my friend Rachel.
Okay. And how, so that was in 2019?
Yes. Like the end. Yeah. Beginning of 2019.
So, you know, we're 2024. How has that journey been for you, building your business? What have you learned about yourself along the way?
Well, I learned that, you know, I can learn anything if I want to. And the more that you help others grow, the more that you will grow. Just the people that I've met just by, you know, leading workshops and doing mission stuff and then doing the popcorn stuff. Like there's so many different areas that I work in and where it's like women in leadership. Like now I'm traveling across the world traveling across Canada doing speaking engagements. Right. And, so I think, oh, fuck, I forgot the question. What is the gap on that?
What do you, what have you learned about yourself along the way? Yeah.
Okay. So do we get the first part? What have I learned? Oh yeah. I can learn. What I've learned about myself is that I can learn anything that I want.
Yeah.
I've learned my distractions. I've learned that this won't be my last mistake, and that's okay. Because often, come back next time you make this big mistake, but you can't be afraid to fail again. It's just you have to know how to get back up.
Yeah.
And that's like the ethos of making a comeback.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. When you are going on, these speaking engagements across the country, what are some of the stories that you've kind of heard where people have come up to you? Like, have you had individuals come up and kind of share their own stories with you? And how has that kind of further impacted your perspective?
Yeah, like, so I spoke on a bank tour, right? Which is great. I spoke to all these young farmers about finding purpose in your work. So emotional profit. And people come up to me and they'll tell me about someone that they love that is struggling or they're struggling with their own personal journey with imposter syndrome.
Mm-hmm.
So, for me, I knew that I couldn't keep this whole thing. This is like in total 7 years of my life. I wasn't going to not share that journey because I know there's so much that other people can learn from it. Mm-hmm. And I've even helped like law enforcement and police officers. And so it's been so interesting to really see all the different ways that your story can help people, right? And it's not just about the formerly incarcerated. It can be about anyone that, you know, needs a comeback.
Yeah. The other thing too is that I think when it comes to that discussion around, going to prison and being incarcerated, like it seems like for a lot of people that's not something that could ever happen to them, and it's they're kind of completely divorced from even having to confront that conversation and that idea. And then like as we're talking, it can literally happen to anyone in the blink of an eye too. So I guess it's like also opening up the conversation with people that where that conversation would not even necessarily enter their minds necessarily as well, right?
Mm-hmm.
That's really interesting. Is there anything that you wish you knew about entrepreneurship before you had started that you now know now?
Well, I think entrepreneurship it's a wild, wacky world. It's like a spider web. Sometimes, sometimes you're the one, sometimes you're the spider and sometimes you're the fly.
Yeah.
Right?
Right.
That gets stuck. So, and it can change, but just try to find something good in every day. You have to find something good in every day. And entrepreneurship can come from the most unlikely of places, right? It can come from prison. So it doesn't matter where it comes from, but if you believe in what you're doing and the purpose that you have and who you're trying to serve and what you're trying to build, then it can happen anywhere.
How do you measure, I guess, the success of your company and your business beyond just like financial metrics? What does success mean to you?
Motivation, you know, getting up every day and like being excited, right? Obviously there's going to be days where you're like, oh God, like I have to do this like 3-hour Zoom meeting. But it's knowing that what you're doing is helping someone and reminding yourself of that, and just keep trying to, you never know how you can help people, right? It can be like connecting someone with someone else. It can be a text message. And so I think that's what keeps me going.
We're talking about the growth of your business. So when we think about the next 5 years, the next 10 years, what's your biggest hope for the business?
Well, we're going to be all over the U.S. in the next 5 to 10 years. We've already started, working in the arenas. Madison Square Garden, Rogers Center will be the summer.
Major.
Yeah.
Major.
Yeah.
That's so exciting. So, I mean, the U.S. is also just like a beast of a market.
Yeah.
It's like the population, when you just consider how big the country is compared to ours, I should say how big the population is. That's a huge other undertaking. So how do you approach scaling your business up to meet a market like that?
Well, you have to have the right people around you. So we have a really great board of advisors, people that have built food companies that are in the U.S. because you're right, so many companies have tried to go into the U.S., crash and burn. It's extremely expensive. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not something you don't do the whole country at one time. You start by state, you start by region. And it's, again, it's slow growth because, again, you can crash and burn so fast. But, you know, we have a great team. You know, Peter and Chris Neal from the Neal Brothers. You know, Michael Lyons from Simply Protein. There's so many people, like, in the snack space that have tremendous experience and tremendous belief in the brand. And then, you know, just hanging with people like you that'll help get the message across everywhere else. So yeah. It's that.
how did you build your network of mentors, and also kind of these like big names and talents that could give you the insight into the industry?
Storytelling, you know. After that first article with The Spectator came out, I got more interviews, and so you know, I think my second one was like Vice, and then I was on the CTV morning show, and so. And then we worked with a PR team who kind of taught us the ins and outs of PR. And then they helped us target certain publications. And then I'd get more podcasts from that. And so keep telling your story, and because you never know who's listening. And then every time I do one, it's like the messages that I get are just so nice. And someone always knows someone, or like there's always a connection somewhere, which is great. And because people can relate to mistakes, people can relate to comebacks. That's why we've had you know, just this great strong group of people.
Yeah.
And strangers. It's like there's been complete strangers that have been awesome.
Yeah. Yeah. So absolutely. what do you think has been the most valuable piece of advice that you've received from your mentors?
Well, don't crash and burn. For sure.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. You know, on the podcast, it's really, you know, we like to talk to entrepreneurs and leaders about their respective journeys and how they got to where they are, but at the core of it, what their mission and purpose is. So what would you say is your mission and purpose?
My mission and purpose is for fighting for second chances for anyone that needs it, for people that need to restart their life. You know, prison isn't just a physical prison. A prison can be emotional. It can be a financial prison.
Yeah.
It can be a marital prison. We've all been in there, and so we all need help getting out of it.
Yeah, yeah, that's great. And what's your definition of glory for you?
Laughing proudly.
I love it. Yeah. I love it. Amazing. Okay, I want to go into a quick second rapid fire, if you're down for that.
Oh, yes. Let's do it.
So this is going to be kind of like a work, just like general rapid fire for yourself. What's your best habit and what's your worst?
My best habit is exercise. My worst habit is,
You don't have any bad habits. I love it. I love it so much.
open tabs on my computer.
That's yes. How many do you have at a time, do you think?
Sometimes 8 to 10. And sometimes I have two two Google Chromes open and then with those tabs. So it's like, I guess like my worst habit is sometimes not being focused on one thing. And so, you know, every day you have to remind yourself to get one thing done.
This is the story of my life. How do you stay productive and focused?
I go to the library a lot.
Okay.
Yeah, because if I work from home, all I do is like want to play with the dogs, eat and watch TV. So I know that I have to go somewhere else to work. And I know that I have to keep my driving limited. Like I can't be like driving for hours every day, because then I just then you're like, oh, I hate driving. Then you begin to hate your day, and so you have to like really manage your time properly, especially in this chaotic city.
Yes, traffic. Yes. What's the first thing you do before bed, and the first thing you do when you wake up?
First thing I do before bed is brush my teeth, and the first thing I do when I wake up is make sure I charged my phone the night before.
Are you like an alarm clock person, or do you kind of find that you wake up naturally and you're like a morning person?
Summertime, wake up naturally. Wintertime, alarm clock.
Yeah.
For sure.
And the type of person that sets like a million alarms like every 10, 15 minutes, and it just, my poor partner has to deal with that. And then he ends up getting up earlier than me anyways. How do you like to unwind?
I am like a hot Pilates exercise person, so I like to just sweat.
Yeah, love it, love it. Sure. What do you do when you're creatively stuck?
Travel, like go away on like a weekend, go away for a weekend. You know, it's not like running away from the problem, it's helping to source solutions to the problem, I think.
What is the lesson that took you the longest to learn about yourself?
That apologies aren't, when you apologize to someone, like you don't necessarily, you aren't granted that for sure, you know, but you have to learn how to do it. And apologies aren't a text message. They're not like one word. They are like a process, and you have to put real effort into them. And that was like one thing I learned, you know, especially with my family. You know, they bent over backwards for me, even though I'd kind of like messed up pretty bad, despite whatever had happened. Like they still suffered a lot. And so I learned that, you know, you have to learn how to apologize.
I love that. What does grit mean to you?
Grit means like rolling around in the dirt and loving it and knowing that you're strong enough to get back up.
Yeah. And who's been your greatest teacher and why?
My mom, because she's like relentlessly positive, but not scared to share her feelings, but just believes in me and her like unconditional love. Like my mom and my dad, basically. But I spent more time with my mom on house arrest. But yeah, she was awesome. And like, I wouldn't be here if it wasn't for her.
I love it. Thanks so much, Emily.
Go Heidi.
This is so great. I'm so glad that we got to have this one-on-one chat. And it's honestly, you have such an incredible story and something that so many people can learn from, you know, regardless of their circumstances. Everyone goes through their own, as you said, like their own kind of prison, whether it's emotional or mental or physical, whatever it might be, they're going through some sort of challenge or need a second chance, right? Mm-hmm. And I think that that's why your story is like resonates with so many people, because there's a way that people can see themselves in your kind of story as well.
Oh, well,
so it's so great. Yay. I really appreciate the time. Thank you so
much.
Of course.
Can't wait for your next party.
Yeah, exactly. If you enjoyed this episode, we'd really appreciate it if you left a review on Apple Podcasts. Let us know what you liked, who you'd like to see on the show, and anything else you want to share. To keep up to date, subscribe to our podcast on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, or anywhere else you listen to your podcasts. Until next time, ask yourself, what's your mission?